This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, COVID case numbers climbing in 40 states. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former FDA chief, on what we missed before the pandemic.
There are a lot of gaps in our preparedness, and this isn't a sort of new problem. This has been building over many years.
And what there is still not enough of.
We haven't invested in infrastructure, so we don't have the ability to surge testing capacity in this country. It took us months and months to get where we are, and we still don't have enough testing.
And Mark Cuban's tips for day traders, patience, and historical perspective are key to success.
Yeah, I think we're very similar to what's going on in the 1990s. And, you know, as I look at my portfolio, I have to keep on reminding myself that the internet bubble lasted multiple years.
It's Monday, July 20th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Here we go. The vaccine news du jour. This is important, though, and it could be one way or another. We're expecting more detailed results from phase one trials of the vaccine candidate, the Oxford University and AstraZeneca candidate. They've already begun large scale phase three human trials, but we still don't know yet much about the phase one results, which would show whether it's safe and whether it includes an immune response. And this is a very prestigious journal. The results are being published in The Lancet, the British publication. It's going to come out sometime today.
Here's my question. As a scientist who's actually published in the past on this,
yes,
would you normally publish your results in one of these publications and make a big deal about it if it was a failure, or do they only do that if it's generally good news? I mean, or wouldn't you generally just put out the bad news and not necessarily publish on it?
It's an important. You'd have to do it either way. If it really sucked, you'd still have to put out obviously
to publish it and put it in a big.
Let everybody know. That's the way it works. So otherwise, if you only publish positive things, you know, people would repeat the experiment or something like that if it doesn't work.
Fingers crossed. Which path not to take, I guess.
This is the one. Yeah. This is a leading candidate along with there's four or five leading candidates, but this is definitely, you know, top three.
What I didn't realize is there's about 200 candidates out there for one of these vaccines. And obviously only a few of them are going to be brought to market. So these analysts were saying, you know, you've got a lot of these stocks that are incredibly overvalued at this point because the market has played up every single one of them that has come down. It would be great to get multiple ones of these that actually work because you have such a huge global population that needs to be vaccinated. You would need to get that out and get it produced very quickly. But you're not going to get 200 of them. And that was just their point looking through some of this. We have a lot of hopes riding on this, but not every company is going to be successful.
I saw another anecdotal story about a 64-year-old guy that died like 2 days later. So it was awful reading about this. Can I just say one positive thing I heard over the weekend watching the memorial, the great Jack Nicklaus tournament in Columbus, Ohio at Muirfield? John Rahm, number one in the world now. Jack Nicklaus and his wife both had COVID. They disclosed back in March.
Oh, wow.
Both had COVID. Jack is 80.
Wow.
Jack is 80. His wife, I don't know if she's quite 80, but they're similar ages. She was asymptomatic. Right. He had a sore throat and a cough for a week. And it was so. They're,
God bless.
Yeah, exactly. And he said we were very lucky and everything else. But, you know, for I don't know if we hear about those stories. I mean, it's tragic. And I just read about a 64-year-old guy that doesn't happen with the flu normally, obviously, unless you've got a lot of comorbidities. But, you know, just hearing that, I was like, Jack, yes, you know, 80, no problem with COVID. So and we want to have him around, obviously, for as long as we possibly can. Tough course, showed its teeth, very tough.
An update now on the coronavirus pandemic by the numbers. The U.S. case total has passed 3.7 million, with 140,000 deaths in this country from COVID-19. Florida reported more than 12,000 cases yesterday, the fifth straight day above 10,000 over the last week. Around 18% of all tests came back positive in Florida. The state's governor, Ron DeSantis, urges perspective.
My message is, you know, the fear is our enemy. You know, let's understand. I mean, there's obviously things that Floridians are doing and that we're doing, whether it's working with hospitals, whether it's doing some of the other stuff. But there is that. And I think the other thing that gets missed with the cases is the sheer number of people who are testing who aren't sick. Because I think most people see, you know, cases and they're like, they think that many people are in the hospital or are going to go. And the way this disease is it's largely, particularly for people who are under 60, either minimally or asymptomatic.
And Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, who has thus far resisted calls for a statewide mask order, warned over the weekend his state, with 73,000 total COVID cases, could be going in the wrong direction.
When we reopened, we put in place, we were one of the first states to put in place a very sophisticated policy about how you reopen. And that has included a mask requirement for every employee. As far as customers now coming in, as you pointed out, we're at 60%. Frankly, we've seen that go up as our counties have turned red. We're going the wrong way. We're at a crucial time. And so this week you may see a lot more counties under that mask requirement. So we certainly would not rule out going statewide.
These numbers, 73,000, 3.7 million, can boggle the mind. In his latest op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb dives into the disagreement on who reports those numbers and when between the Cabinet Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control. Gottlieb says the feud demonstrates the inadequacy of U.S. efforts to prepare for a pandemic. Here's Becky.
Dr. Gottlieb, thanks for being here, and it's good to talk to you about this new op-ed that you have out.
Thanks a lot, Becky.
Let's dive into this, because this is an issue that we discussed a couple of times last week. Why these two agencies are feuding, what they're doing about it, how they're collecting information, and I think probably pretty importantly, what this means overall in terms of the strategy we take in the months to come. If things get worse here in the United States, are we prepared?
Well, this has been a longstanding dispute or discomfort between the administration and CDC, from what I can glean talking to people on the inside. There's been frustration with the CDC in terms of the inability to get timely information and accurate information out of the agency. Some of that's legitimate, probably some of it's, you know, a little stretched. But the final straw came last week when the administration, some administration officials, had asked the CDC to give them data on the age breakdown of people being hospitalized in the South for COVID, and CDC told them that they wouldn't be able to provide that information until late August or September. And that's when the decision was made to more fully take away data aggregation from CDC. CDC would still be involved in analyzing the data, but they'd no longer be the lead agency collecting the data. I still think a preferable path would have been to try to support the CDC. I think the CDC should be the lead agency, but clearly we need to invest more in their capabilities to both collect and disseminate information. We're at a point right now where some hospitals are literally faxing in information to the agency. The agency needs to rebuild its data systems. And to the agency's credit, they've asked for resources for many years to do that, and so this has been something that's been recognized for a long time.
The Washington Post had an article this weekend that said the White House is seeking to block billions of dollars for states to conduct testing and do contact tracing, and then also additional money to go to the CDC and to be used internationally to try and fight this pandemic. The Post said that this is creating problems even with Republican senators at this point. What do you hear on this? What do you think about this? And just in terms of what should be done with the testing policy, should that be a national policy, or should that be something where the states pick it up themselves?
Well, I've talked to people on Capitol Hill, and I think the funding is going to be there. Congress is going to provide that funding, including Republicans. I talked to Republican staffers on the Senate side. I think in part this reflects some of the frustrations we talked about at the outset. I think the White House and others in the administration have some frustrations with the CDC and don't want to provide more resources and sort of double down on the agency's role right now. But it also reflects an inability to come up with a plan to really reform the agency, because a funding bill would be a good place to try to come up with a different approach to how CDC engages on these issues, and they haven't been able to do that. Obviously something hard to do in the setting of a crisis, to try to rebuild aspects of an agency that have been long ignored, but that would be probably the preferable way to go. I just think it reveals that there are a lot of gaps in our preparedness, and this isn't a sort of new problem. This has been building over many years, and that was sort of the point of my op-ed this morning. The intelligence community has been recommending in public documents for many years that we treat the risk of pandemics as a national security threat on par with the risk from weapons of mass destruction and cyber attacks and terrorism. And we haven't done that. We haven't invested in infrastructure, so we don't have the ability to surge testing capacity in this country. It took us months and months to get where we are, and we still don't have enough testing. We don't have the domestic capacity to manufacture vaccines and biologics at the scale that we would need heading into the fall, particularly the biological drugs, the antibody-based drugs. And we don't have the data systems we need to both collect and track the ebbs and flows of this epidemic. My colleague at Johns Hopkins, Caitlin Rivers, has proposed the idea of creating a national tracking service similar to the National Weather Forecasting Service that would be in charge of collecting and disseminating information and analyzing it. We don't have that kind of capability here in the United States.
Hey, Scott, prepare us for the Oxford AstraZeneca result. What do we know so far? There's so many. I just want to know exactly what is the mechanism, again, of this one? This is not a messenger RNA one, is it? Is this a more classic one or an adenovirus one? Which one is this?
It's a simian adenovirus, there's been data released on it already that was encouraging. I think with all, what I would call a little bit of hype heading into the announcement today, most people are probably expecting the results to be positive. It's just a phase one, phase two study. Richard Horton, the editor-in-chief of The Lancet, put out a very unusual tweet last night that was basically three words that seemed to be intimating some positive news on the vaccine. He said tomorrow period, vaccines period, just saying period. So not the typical kind of tweet you see from the editor-in-chief of a major medical journal.
That's unbelievable.
That's crazy.
That. Yeah.
Is that almost...
Is he a friend of Elon Musk?
That almost seems like front-writing.
Yeah.
Hey, doctor, I have two questions for you. One was what you made of this study that came out over the weekend out of South Korea, about 65,000 people looking at children and their role as potential spreaders, and this idea that between 10 and 19, so if you're older than 10 years old, that you're no different than if you're 30, 40, or 50 years old in terms of your ability to spread it, and if that's right, what that means, of course, for school openings and therefore the economy here in the United States, the debate with teachers' unions, and all of it.
So this was an exquisite study, as the South Koreans have done throughout this epidemic. They looked at about 60,000 contacts of around almost 4,000 people who were infected with COVID and tracked how those infected people, the index cases, went on to infect other people. Now, they only followed symptomatic people. So these were children who had become symptomatic from COVID. And what it showed was that for the kids aged 10 to 19, they were the most likely to infect other household members at, I believe, 18.6%. Children younger than that were less likely to infect other household members. But the kicker here is that it was only a very small number of children. So I think there were about 150 kids in all that had become symptomatic and were followed in this study. So what it suggests is that kids are less likely to become symptomatic from COVID because the number of kids in the study that were caught with COVID that had symptomatic COVID was relatively small, but when they do get symptomatic COVID, perhaps they're just as likely, if not more likely, to spread the virus. And that might not be because they shed more virus. It might be behaviors. You know, when kids are sick, we're still going to hug and kiss them and go close to them, versus when an adult is sick in the household, they might be more likely to self-quarantine.
If you're asymptomatic, does that mean you're less likely to spread? That just seems the information I would take away from what you just said. Is that not accurate?
The study didn't speak to that one way or the other, but it does. But there is belief that a lot of children get sort of subclinical infection. They get asymptomatic infection, and they're less likely to shed virus when they're asymptomatic. There are some studies showing that when you're asymptomatic, you're less likely to spread the virus. And on the CDC's website, when CDC gives guidance to modelers, they ask modelers to make certain assumptions, and one of the assumptions right now that they're asking modelers to make is that asymptomatic people are, I believe, 50% as likely to spread the virus as those who are symptomatic. So there's already a general belief that when you're asymptomatic, you're less likely to spread it. There's a general belief that most kids, when they do get infected with coronavirus, they're asymptomatic. But what this South Korean study suggested is that when they get infected and they get symptomatic, they're just as likely to spread it as an adult.
Hey, Scott, one last question, which is, obviously the news, and you guys were talking about it earlier, about testing and tracing. You know, with the Trump administration saying that they don't want to spend or they want to block the $25 billion for some of the testing and tracing, My question is actually to reverse the whole idea. How much would it cost if we said we wanted to do 5 million tests a day, and we're doing less than a million a day now, 5 million tests a day, 10 million tests a day, how long would it take to ramp up, and how much would it cost?
Well, it's hard for me to put a price tag on how much it would cost to ramp up. You know, the tests run about $50 cost of goods on a test. At scale, it's going to come down. What needs to happen, the real swing capacity in this country, so 25% of tests are point-of-care tests. They're done quickly. 25% of tests are in-hospital tests. Those get turned around quickly by hospital labs. The other 50% are largely being run by the commercial labs, and that's what's getting overwhelmed. And what needs to happen is those commercial labs need to make significant capital expenditures to build out their lab capacity so they can expand the use of their laboratory-developed tests. My hunch is that they're reluctant to make tremendous capital expenditures because COVID testing is a market that's likely to go away at some point, and they can't reconvert that capacity to other uses. And so that there might be a role for the government to inject money quickly to try to expand that lab capacity, recognizing that we're going to have to mothball it at some point. Now, doing that, you can't just switch that on overnight. And so investments we make right now, it'll take a couple of months to get those labs validated and up and running. And the biggest bottleneck, quite frankly, is hiring the lab techs. You need an army of lab techs to do the sample prep, and that's really the bottleneck, getting those skilled personnel on board.
Dr. Gottlieb, thank you. You have been with us almost every morning for, I think, 4.5 months, maybe longer now. We appreciate having you here. They've been trying to wrap us for 5 minutes, and obviously we still have questions to keep you here. So we'll talk to you again very soon, and we do appreciate
Thanks
your time this morning. Take care.
Next on Squawk Pod, Dallas Mavericks owner and entrepreneur Mark Cuban on the pandemic, the markets, and trading up.
This market, you can be a trader, but longer term, traders typically end up losing all their money.
Cuban's dose of wisdom for traders, even the ones on TikTok.
Everybody's a genius in a bull market.
We'll be right back. This is Squawk Pod.
Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Joe Kernan along with Becky Quick and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Let's stick with the coronavirus and the surging number of cases around the country. Texas is among the states seeing a spike in deaths and in hospitalizations, with the governor there now pleading for the use of masks. Joining us right now to talk about business in the Lone Star State and what it needs to do to get the current outbreak under control is Mark Cuban. He's an entrepreneur, he's a philanthropist, and of course, you know, he's also the owner of the NBA's Dallas Mavericks. Mark, it's great to have you on again. It's been a while since we've spoken.
Thanks for having me.
Give us an update. The last time we talked with you, you were kind of going around seeing how many of the different businesses that were slowly starting to open up were actually following the CDC guidelines at that point. You had hired mystery shoppers to go out and find out some of this information, but a lot has happened since then. So just get us up to speed on what you're seeing in your home state.
Yeah, we haven't surveyed in the last couple of weeks, but just anecdotally, driving around and trying to do business here in Dallas, more businesses are shutting down. It's not worth it for them to stay open. You see a lot more people becoming more concerned. Going into a restaurant, people are wearing masks now in the restaurant, where, you know, in June, in early July, when we first opened up, that wasn't the case. And so people are recognizing that this is scary. I get a daily report from the mayor's office. And fortunately, last night was the first time in weeks that the ICU utilization rate in Dallas was under 70%. And the number of cases was down minimally. So hopefully that's a trend that will continue.
You know, you said something really interesting. There are businesses, you can say anecdotally, that are closing, not because they've been told to, not because they've been required by the government, but because it's just not worth staying open. And I think that's the question that so many people are trying to figure out, because that could be the really huge impact on the economy. Is there a point where it's just not even worth it to open your doors because you're losing more money than you're taking in?
Yeah, no question. We had a lot of zombie companies because of the PPP money, right? They weren't actually doing enough business to stay open, but they were able to sustain their business and keep employees on payroll because of the PPP funds. And you saw a lot of those companies also being able to sustain themselves minimally because we saw a surge in personal income, and people were spending a lot of that money, even though savings rates was very high, people were spending that money online. And so there was a little bit of an equilibrium. But I think, you know, now with people becoming more concerned here in Dallas in particular, you're seeing a drop off in that retail component. and businesses just don't feel it's worthwhile to keep the retail side of their businesses open. I know in my Shark Tank companies, we had not pivoted, but evolved a lot of their business to be as much online as possible. And that's really made a huge difference. And so I can't say why the businesses are closing, whether it's because they just can't do enough business, period, and they close their entire businesses, or whether they've just evolved to being online so that that is really the focus of their business now.
Hey, Mark, I have two questions for you. One is, you know, given the renewed efforts at maybe the next version of PPP or whatever we're going to get in terms of stimulus, what would you think of trying to tie that money to rules of the road, health standards, maybe mandatory masking and the like, so we don't get in this situation where we're throwing good money after bad all over again?
No, I don't think you can tie it to wearing masks and protocols, because there are no protocols for businesses, right? They really don't know what they're supposed to do. The CDC has kind of fallen off the map in trying to support particularly small businesses. So I don't think you can tie it. And so, you know, I think it's really got to be on the demand side. It's going to be very difficult to extend PPP when there's already over $100 billion there. You know, just saying, okay, come back and apply again. I don't know that that's targeted enough. But on the flip side, I think we do need to do stimulus again for consumers, and it's got to be use it or lose it, because at that point, you'll see an increase in demand because of that available cash. And I think that's what's going to keep companies in business.
Mark, I also wanted to raise a tweet that you sent out in the past 12 hours that's trending on Twitter this morning. You responded to a talk show host who said that they're psyched for the Mavericks this year, but said the minute one player kneels during the anthem, I'm out. And they basically went after you and said that you should deal with this. You wrote back, the national anthem police in this country are out of control. If you want to complain, complain to your boss and ask why they don't play the national anthem every day before you start work. What are you anticipating this season's going to be like? And what do you say to those folks out there who may share the opinion of Mark Davis, who you responded to on Twitter?
Yeah, look, everybody has the right to think what they choose. This is a bigger issue. This hopefully is going to be a pivotal time in our history, and trying to end systemic racism, using the platform that we have with the NBA to try to really get people to understand the challenges of African Americans in this country is paramount. That's more important than anything else we do. And, you know, when people talk about shut up and dribble, or, you know, I don't turn to sports to hear politics, it's not like in the middle of an NBA game we're going to start having interviews about political issues. That's not the case at all. The perspective that people get on our political stances, where they may occur, doesn't come from the NBA. It comes from all the commentary outside the NBA. So if you don't want to hear about politics, turn off all the political networks. You know, just turn on the game, and I think you're going to enjoy some great NBA basketball. We have scrimmages starting next week. Our games start July 30th. The NBA, you know, is on a course to be back, and I think that's great for us, great for our fans, and great for the country.
Mark, anything that could interrupt that? I mean, you guys must be watching very closely, testing very closely, kind of seeing what's happening in other sports as well. What are you doing to make sure that you do get there? What are the concerns you have that you might not?
Well, obviously, you know, when you have, you know, 300 some individuals, 400, I guess, in total with staff, you have to be very careful about their health. But the interesting thing, this is one big psychological experiment where we're quarantining all these professionals. And they're really adapting well. I mean, I can only speak for the Mavs, but our guys are getting along great. They're following the rules. They're wearing their masks. You know, if people in the real world outside of the NBA followed, you know, the masking protocols the same way that NBA players are, we'd already be dealing with this virus and be way ahead of where we are now, and probably in a much better place.
You've heard the pushback from some of the marquee players in the NFL saying, what is the NFL doing to protect me and my family, signing a letter, writing some of these things. What do you think you guys are doing differently in the NBA?
Well, you know, we have 17 players now per team, as opposed to 53 plus all the staff, and their staffs are much larger than ours. So they've got a different challenge than we do. It'd be very difficult for them to quarantine in one location. I haven't heard anything suggesting that they're trying to do that. Whereas with us, we have one location. we're able to keep everything under control. There's perimeters that we watch. There's protocols that we enforce very strictly. And so I think we have the advantage there that the NFL doesn't have. So I can't speak for them, but I think it's a little bit easier for us.
Hey, let's turn back to the markets a little bit and just the trend that we've seen recently of the Nasdaq very recently. And I just mean in the last week, the Nasdaq kind of gave back some of the gains that it had picked up. It was the S&P and the Dow that did better last week. What do you think about technology stocks here? What do you think about growth stocks versus value stocks?
I think people are just chasing performance. I mean, it's a momentum-based market. You know, I don't think this is a fundamentals-driven market and hasn't been since the Fed intervened. You know, I think people are trying to say, what's next? Where's all the money going to go next? And then they try to get ahead of that. And then that plays out. Then they go back to where they were with tech. We've seen this many, many times before. And, you know, and it's just part of what happens in a bull market.
You lived through 1999. Do you think this is anything like that when you say momentum and just chasing momentum and getting away from it? Or is this very different because you see a lot of these companies like a Microsoft and Amazon that really have been putting up some numbers, too?
You know, in some respects, it's different because of the Fed and the liquidity they've introduced and the inflation for financial assets that comes with that. But on a bigger picture, it's so similar. I mean, I had my 18-year-old niece asking me, you know, what stock she should invest in because her friends are making 30% per day, you know, and other people just randomly asking me that never look at stocks at all, what stocks that they should invest in. You know, everybody's a genius in a bull market and everybody's making money right now because you've got the Fed put. And, you know, that brings people in who otherwise wouldn't participate. You've got all the free traders, you know, that what would have been the analogous to the day traders of the late 90s that can come in and trade for free. They can trade fractionalized stocks. So it's easy for them to, you know, put in a little bit of money, look and see that they're up 30%, you know, that they've made, relatively speaking, a lot of money for themselves. And that's going to keep them participating. And so, yeah, I think we're very similar to what's going on in the 1990s. And, you know, as I look at my portfolio, which is still very heavy on Amazon and Netflix, I have to keep on reminding myself that the internet bubble lasted multiple years. You know, it went from 1995 to early 2000. And so it wasn't like, oh, we're in a bubble, then all of a sudden the bubble is over months later. It lasted for years. And so it's difficult to have patience sometimes and recognize that there's still a lot of money that can come in and chase that performance. You know, people tell their friends, hey, look at how much money I'm making. You know, my niece and her friends, you know, other kids that I know are asking me questions on TikTok about stocks. And so it's different, but it's so analogous in so many ways. But we still have to be patient. It doesn't mean it's going to end tomorrow.
So what did you tell your 18-year-old niece to do?
I said, there's a reason why people sell you that stock. And it's not because they think the price is going up, you know. And so you've always got to be careful and understand what you're doing. And then the second thing I told her, if you do it and you make money, the only way you get to keep that money is by cashing out. Don't get greedy. Pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. And so I said, you know, this is a little bit different, but this is also a chance for you to learn how the market works and how companies work. So if you are willing to take the time, I'm happy to help you.
Yeah. You want to be an investor, not a trader, though, right?
Yeah. In this market, you can be a trader, but longer term, traders typically end up losing all their money. And so you want to be an investor longer term and understand what you're doing.
Mark, thank you. It's great to see you. And I hope we get to talk to you again soon.
Always. Thanks for having me on.
We'll be right back. And that's the show for today. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. And to get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.